Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, former Federal Reserve Chair Alan Greenspan is back in the news. He has a memoir out in which he tries to put some space between himself and the Bush White House. Will the press, never inclined to challenge the man they call the maestro, facilitate Greenspan's reinvention? We'll talk with one journalist who's not a fan, Nation correspondent and author William Grider. Also on Counterspin today, Blackwater security contractors in Iraq are being blamed for a September 16th shooting in Baghdad that killed 8 Iraqis. It's not the first time something like this has happened, but the Iraqi government's response has made it big news in the U.S. media, forcing outlets to acknowledge some awkward facts about the nature of the Iraq war that rarely make the papers. We'll talk about that issue with Anthony Arnoff, author of the book Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal. All that's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press.
Hillary Clinton unveiled her health care proposal this week, and much of the media coverage referenced Clinton's failed health care plan of the early 1990s. A September 16th New York Times Week in Review article attempted to cover some of that history, at one point noting that the lesson of that failure was that altruism has its limits, as if a system designed to benefit a few large insurance companies could plausibly be labeled as such. But perhaps oddest was the apparent surprise of some reporters that Clinton's plan was attacked by, who would have guessed it, her Republican opponents. A September 19th Times article claimed that Clinton so much as talking about health care, quote, summons up images and film of that younger, far more combative Hillary still deep in the American memory bank. Her critics noted that even this week, when her policy proposal received a generally positive response, Mrs. Clinton still managed to stir a fiercely ideological attack from the opposition as if it were 1994 all over again, close quote. It's not at all clear what's in that memory bank, since Clinton polls pretty well on this issue. But parsing this can make your head spin. Clinton's critics launched immediate attacks on her proposal, which they said show she is a divisive figure. And the Times offered additional evidence to support this. Why, the Republican National Committee sent out a press release calling her proposal more big government bureaucracy. This is a surprise? Political reporters should know better than anyone that political parties regularly attack their opponents' ideas. A more useful press corps would sort out the facts instead of merely marveling at the partisanship or one candidate's inherent divisiveness.
Well, speaking of sorting out the facts, in his September 16th commentary, CBS Face the Nation anchor Bob Schieffer expressed bafflement at how to find the truth in competing claims about the Iraq War. Quote, think about it. General Petraeus told us the administration policy has led to some success in Iraq. Critics said it has led to total failure. The general said violence is down in Iraq. Critics challenged his figures, said violence is up. Close quote. Schieffer went on to puzzle at, quote, how people could look at the same situation and come to such opposite conclusions about what they saw. Close quote. Well, Schieffer is apparently unaware that it's a journalist's job to sort through claims and find out who is telling the truth, as other journalists have done, for instance, in challenging Petraeus's claims that Iraq has become less violent because of the U.S. escalation there. While Schieffer seems to prefer stenography to journalism, ABC White House correspondent Ann Compton has a different but equally strange notion of what her job is. On the September 16th edition of CNN's Reliable Sources, anchor Howard Kurtz asked how journalists should cover George W. Bush's upbeat Iraq speech. Is it your job, he asked, to say, hold on, that's an incomplete picture, that's perhaps a distorted picture? Compton's response was odd. Quote, sure it is. But you know, that speech was written so well, so carefully, that it gave us 5 or 6 really great sound bites on bringing them home. All the buzzwords, getting better, progress, close quote. In other words, Compton seemed to be saying, yes, a speech should be fact-checked unless it's particularly well-crafted.
And finally, when most of the so-called top-tier Democratic presidential candidates chose to skip a debate hosted by Fox News, there was a fair amount of discussion over it. Republican candidates seem to be attracting less attention for their decision to avoid both a debate hosted by Spanish-language network Univision that was subsequently postponed, and more recently one hosted by black talk show host Tavis Smiley at Morgan State University. According to a September 19th Washington Post story, though, there are some who think that running away from chances to talk to people of color is bad for Republicans seeking the White House. And, interestingly, they are people within the GOP, like Jack Kemp and Newt Gingrich. The Post's description of one such critic must have surprised readers, though. Explaining why former Republican National Committee Chair Ken Mellman opposes the candidates avoiding these forums, the paper describes Mellman as a, quote, longtime aide to President Bush, who aggressively courted the minority vote as RNC chairman in 2005 and 2006. He recruited black candidates to run for office as Republicans and condemned electoral tactics that showed hints of race baiting, close quote. What's that now? Observers saw more than a hint of race baiting in an attack ad that Mellman's RNC ran just last year against black Tennessee senatorial candidate Harold Ford. That would be the one that ended with a white woman who met Harold Ford at the Playboy party, winking and saying, "Harold, call me." Although the ad included the sentence, "The Republican National Committee is responsible for the content of this advertisement," Mellman insisted that he didn't have the authority to take it down or put it up because it was an independent expenditure. As for condemnation, Mellman had some, but only for the ad's critics, saying, quote, "I think it's a fair ad. I just think those criticisms of it are wrong," close quote. Perhaps the Post is thinking of someone else.
Thank you, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. FAIR also publishes a bi-monthly magazine called Extra. I'll be giving more information about that later on in the program. Alan Greenspan is the sort of person about whom the Los Angeles Times would report, quote, "Whether on Wall Street or Pennsylvania Avenue, no voice carries more weight on economic matters in the United States than that of Greenspan, his status as a former notwithstanding," close quote. Newsweek headlines their interview, "The Oracle Reveals All." Given that, it's reasonable to question whether corporate media will permit the former Federal Reserve chair, who has just released a memoir, to write his own legacy. Press attention has focused on Greenspan's backing off from a statement he made in the book about the Iraq War being about oil. But what about his descriptions of the economic policies he supported and their impacts? What should reporters be asking the man some call the maestro about those? Joining us now to talk about Greenspan and the press is William Grider, national affairs correspondent at The Nation magazine and author most recently of The Soul of Capitalism, Opening Paths to a Moral Economy. He joins us now by phone from Vermont. Welcome to Counterspin, William Grider.
Thanks, Janine.
Well, Alan Greenspan is now criticizing the Bush White House for straying from conservative economic policy of small government and holding down spending, so forth. As someone who watched his term very carefully, how close is this Alan Greenspan to that one? Is this a wholesale reinvention?
He's rewriting the record, or trying to. It's quite amazing, actually. He's only been out of that office about a year or so. But I think he recognizes that the bones he left behind are now beginning to smell a bit. We have a financial crisis, which has been written about a lot. We're on the edge of a recession. The United States economy is, notwithstanding the usual headlines, is in terrible shape for the long term. And Greenspan had a major, maybe the most important role in creating that. So now he wants to go back and say, well, actually, I didn't do this. I didn't mean that. It's quite extraordinary. And of course, the press, true to form, is mostly being deferential and accepting his revisions. Well, now we know what he really thinks. He was in this job 18 years, and we finally have to get the truth out of him. Well, it's not the truth. He's really literally rewriting history.
Well, he's not getting a completely free ride. Paul Krugman took him on in the New York Times. Yeah. The Washington Post editorial had him as not entirely blameless.
That's tough, yeah.
He has had an extra sweet ride with the media, hasn't he, all along?
Yeah, and in the context of that institution, the Federal Reserve, that's not new. It's a very intimidating political institution, which pretends not to be political. And the press has mostly always gone along with that. They defer to the Federal Reserve in the way they defer to nobody else in government. And Greenspan was probably the most extreme example of that, for lots of reasons, including the complexity and intimidating nature of the central bank, but also because they thought his idea of what was right for the economy was pretty much what they thought.
Well, perhaps that buy-in may explain a reluctance on the part of media to really challenge those presumptions because they shared them.
Yes, I think that's right.
Greenspan is presented as dry-eyed, as a sort of eminence grease, you know. But you once wrote that, quote, it's not exactly that he lies, but Alan Greenspan certainly ranks among the most duplicitous figures to serve in modern American government, close quote. You said that he corrupted the political dialogue. And I wonder if you can talk about the role that reporters played in abetting that.
Well, it starts with ignorance. Surprise. I spent a number of years producing a book called Secrets of the Temple, How the Federal Reserve Runs the Country. And I say with some pride that it's still in print and sold lots and lots of copies. Even Alan Greenspan, I can say, had it on his shelf when he was at the Fed because you could see it in the pictures of him back behind him. What I came to understand about the complexities of monetary policy, and it is complex, is that it boils down to a number of fairly straightforward propositions. Are you going to favor holding down inflation over growth and employment? Are you going to favor capital over labor, that is, allowing wages to rise in step with economic growth, or financial assets like stocks and bonds and so forth? I mean, these are really core choices of a democracy. And the Fed essentially hides them from public view. That is to keep them, quote, non-political, but of course they're not non-political. And the people who care intensely from the capital interests, that is financiers, bankers, lobby the Fed relentlessly. And they don't lobby in the usual way by turning out campaign contributions, but they stay very close to the inside debates. The public, because it's not very well represented by their elected representatives, is kept distance from those arguments and therefore doesn't even know they're going on, much less have a voice in them. And that's, you can tell from my tone of voice, to me that's the central outrage of this institution. Greenspan commits a heresy, really, within the realm of his own institution by dabbling in the politics relentlessly. He's not the first Fed chairman to do that, but he made common cause with the right-wing ideology of the Republican Party. And he scolded the Democrats relentlessly. When Bill Clinton was president, he got Clinton to take what I think was a very wrong deal to sort of hold down the economy and let's keep inflation going lower and lower and lower, and we'll catch up later. Whereas when Bush comes in, Bush proposes an outrageous, regressive tax-cutting agenda, favoring the very top incomes, etc. And Greenspan comes out and says, yes, I like that. You should do that.
Even though that's one of the things he's now trying to say.
So that's part of what he's rewriting is, well, I didn't really say I endorsed the Bush tax cuts. Well, he did. It's all in the record. He testified to that effect. And he, you know, this is not a stupid person. He knew exactly what he was doing when he made that move.
Well, some of us remember another former government official who had a kind of change of heart about economic policy, David Stockman, Reagan's budget director. But Stockman, it seemed like, had real doubts about what he'd done. This is not Greenspan having doubts about the impact of his policies.
No, and he in Stockman was interesting because I was, as you may remember, talking to him all through that period. I was then an editor at the Washington Post and wrote a piece myself called The Education of David Stockman about those conversations in which he actually, I think quite honestly and against his own interest, acknowledged that his grand theory of right-wing ideology had proved wrong. He thought the Reagan program was going to balance the budget and do all kinds of other good things, and it was simply wrong.
Well, that's certainly not what we're seeing with Alan Greenspan. Let me just ask you finally, whether or not he is successful, does Greenspan's attempt to distance himself from some of the Bush White House's economic policies suggest that there's a real threat to the heyday of those policies? I mean, the essentials that you were talking about, you know, paying for tax cuts for the rich on the backs of workers, that all seems to still be in place.
Well, it is in place now, Janine, but I think you probably see the same thing I observe. It is in collapse, and I mean utter collapse. All of the things they proposed as fundamental economic policy for the U.S. have come to ruin, and that's whether you're talking about the so-called free trade system or holding down inflation, rewarding capital, punishing labor with depressed wages, or deregulation and what we've gotten from that. I could go on with the list. We don't know how quickly and rationally it can be played out in politics, but I think when you look at the 2008 election, that's what it will be about, whether any Democrats have the nerve to say it plainly or not.
We've been speaking with William Grider. You can follow his work in The Nation magazine. His latest book is The Soul of Capitalism, Opening Paths to a Moral Economy. Thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
After Blackwater security contractors in Iraq were accused of killing 8 Iraqi civilians, NBC Pentagon reporter Jim Mikliszewski opened his report by saying this, quote, "It's a name that we've heard many times before. Blackwater, the private firm that has about 1,000 armed security guards inside Iraq," close quote. Well, we counted maybe 6 references to Blackwater on NBC's newscast over the last few years, so this surely isn't something the network's spending much time explaining to its viewers. They're not alone. Outside of a few special investigations, the privatized forces in Iraq are yet another angle of the Iraq war and occupation that goes begging for media scrutiny. Joining us now to shed some light on this is Anthony Arnov. He's most recently the author of the book, Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal. Anthony Arnov, welcome back to Counterspin.
Thanks for having me on the program.
Now, the early reports about this shooting might have been confusing to people because they don't hear a lot about these contractors. No one's really sure how many contractors are in Iraq, and reporters have to find ways to explain that, yes, there are these heavily armed forces inside the country. Many of them work for American companies, but no, there's not a whole lot the Iraqi government can do about it. A headline on the MSNBC website read, "Above the law?" As if it were an open question, the legal status of these contractors seems pretty clear to people who've studied this, right?
Yeah, well, this is a story that investigative reporters such as Jeremy Scahill have been tracking for a couple of years, but as you point out, has been ignored in the establishment media. There is effectively a doubling of the U.S. occupation in Iraq right now through the employment of private contractors, of whom as many as 50,000 are armed, effectively private mercenaries, working in the employ of the U.S. occupation. Blackwater is operating under a contract by the State Department. What's interesting is that very early on in the U.S. occupation, Paul Bremer, who was acting as the colonial viceroy in his capacity as head of the Coalition Provisional Authority, deliberately exempted these mercenaries and other U.S. contractors from Iraqi law. And they've created basically a kind of legal black hole in which these mercenaries can operate without any accountability. And the few times that there have been incidents where Iraqis have tried to pursue contractors for violations, they've been skirted out of the country so as not to have to face any any prosecution. They do technically fall under rules of engagement set down for U.S. contractors, whether that's Pentagon rules or State Department rules. But like we've seen with active duty troops who have engaged in abuses of human rights in Iraq, there's really been no accountability, certainly not up the chain of command.
Surely the massacre at Haditha, it seems most of the participants in that are escaping justice right now. One of the most notable facets of the coverage seems to be the unwillingness of much of the media to state the obvious. There was a New York Times story that referred to the fact that Iraqis are angry about this and that serves to reinforce the feeling among Iraqis here that private security companies care little for Iraqi lives. In a war where perceptions are paramount, the effect is poisonous. You get the sense that it's not the contractor's behavior that's poisonous, it's the perception that Iraqis have of the contractors that's the real problem. It seems 4 years into this war, reporters are still a little suspicious of what Iraqis tell them when they're on the scene of a crime like this.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely right. You see in the coverage, for example, the Associated Press running a story about Blackwater said that they're viewed as mercenaries. Mm-hmm. Not that they are mercenaries, which by any reasonable definition they are, but that Iraqis somehow irrationally view them this way. The Los Angeles Times had an editorial in which they referred to Iraqis, what they see as the impunity with which private contractors have harmed civilians. But the reality is that they have harmed civilians with impunity. It's not just a perception of the Iraqis. These are cases that have been documented, that they could investigate, that they could cite. But instead, it's portrayed as somehow irrationality or emotion on the part of the Iraqi people that they're objecting to the kinds of abuses to which they've been subjected by these private contractors and the fact that no one is being held accountable for them.
There's a kind of a balance built into the media coverage. Blackwater says this happened. All of the Iraqi eyewitnesses say this. So the truth is hard to discern. There was a long piece in the Washington Post today, in fact, that talked about Blackwater's history. And one similar incident to this a couple months back, Blackwater at the scene of the crime said, "We didn't do anything." And then when finally press said, "Oh yeah, okay, we did." So it seems like their credibility should be almost non-existent among the press. There was another interesting thing about the law. There was an editorial in the Los Angeles Times wondering why this Iraqi government that we continually call ineffectual and basically pointless, why they're not just changing the law and prosecuting contractors for committing these crimes. You have to imagine that it's more complicated than that, that the Iraqi government couldn't just with a stroke of its pen put all of the contractors under their jurisdiction.
Yeah, there's this idea that somehow the Iraqis have genuine sovereignty, when in reality the United States is still overwhelmingly calling the shots, putting immense pressure on the Iraqi government to pass legislation, for example, the oil law, which it sees as being in U.S. interests, even if the Iraqi legislators see it quite differently, and then also making it clear that there would be consequences for any legislation that would be against U.S. interests. So there was a call immediately from Condoleezza Rice after the most recent Blackwater incident, and it was reported as her apologizing. But I think the call served another purpose, which was to say to the Iraqi government that we want you not to expel mercenaries from Iraq. We can contain this problem and allow the mercenaries to continue. And it even looks as if Blackwater might be able to continue operating in Iraq. They didn't even have a license to mm-hmm. be suspended in the first place. That's an interesting side note to this story.
Yeah, it's something you find buried deep into these stories that, oh, you can't argue about licensing with them because they don't have one. They're just operating as they wish. Well, you alluded to this earlier, and I think this is an important point to sort of underline the this happens after Petraeus gives his report. There's this discussion of a small reduction in the number of U.S. forces in Iraq. The truth here seems to be that if something actually happened to reduce the number of contractors in Iraq dramatically, the fate of the occupation itself would be thrown into utter chaos. Is that sort of the subtext of all this, that the contractors, although we don't pay any attention to them, are actually really vital to maintaining this occupation?
Absolutely. And I think that's the bigger story here. I mean, the headlines over the last couple of months have been about withdrawals, troop reductions, lowering the number of troops. This is a brilliant example of spin when you consider that right now in Iraq you have the largest U.S. active duty force that has been in the country since the beginning of the invasion in 2003. So the headline should be largest U.S. force, 169,000 troops. Instead, it's about mythical reductions, which may or may not take place if security conditions improve in the eyes of the U.S. war planners. And then every article about the troops, I would say of every 100, maybe only one or two, if that mention this effective doubling of the size of the occupation by the use of mercenaries. And I think that there's an expectation that even if some active duty troops come out, there's still going to be mercenaries, or in fact maybe even a greater reliance on mercenaries. And of course then the other questions that we rarely discuss, the military bases, the fact that the U.S. is building the world's largest embassy of any country in Baghdad and is clearly making plans to be there for many, many years to come.
We've been speaking with Anthony Arnov. He's author of the book Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal. Anthony Arnov, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me on the show.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. FAIR also publishes a bi-monthly magazine. It's called Extra. For subscription information, you can call the following number, 1-800-847-3993. That's 1-800-847-3993. Sign up now and your subscription would begin with the October issue featuring FAIR's new study of poverty coverage, an examination of media's failure to connect the dots between immigration and trade policy, and an expose of the right-wing campaign to smear the legacy of Rachel Carson and promote the use of DDT. That number again, 1-800-847-3993. Be sure and tell them you heard about Extra here on Counterspin. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Peter Hart. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.